Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that this podcast is presented by mybookie.ag and that if you use the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, that you will get a 50% deposit bonus on your first deposit. And given that you are a listener to this podcast, I would assume you're relatively knowledgeable about sports, and I would trust you to try your edge on the online sportsbook. You can lay down some money and get in on the action at one of the safest online sportsbooks in the world. It's the only one that I am currently using. You can wager on all sorts of different outcomes on mybookie.ag, soccer, football, any major league, esports. You can even create your own player props, which is useful for me because if you know anything about me, I do enjoy a good player prop. So if you deposit using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, you get a 50% bonus when you deposit. And I will add this for listeners of the TakeCast. If you deposit using the promo code MATTEK and you send proof of it to me on Twitter, I will follow you on Twitter and you can have access to me via DMs whenever you want. That's the TakeCast bonus that I'm adding in association with the mybookie.ag deposit bonus. Now let's get back to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TakeCast. I am here with an absolute legend. I am here with the first ever guest on the Sports Wonderkin podcast, Rich Rebar, Lord Reeves, or if you were on Twitter for 2 weeks in 2015, Roto Reeves. My guy, how are you doing?
Man, that might have been more like 2.5 days, the Roto Reeves.
It may have been 2.5 hours. There was a lot of back on the Roto Reeves.
There wasn't. And amazingly, no one scooped that Lord Reeves handle in that downtime. Maybe just no one was worthy. I don't know. But, man, yeah, we were talking before the show, and the first podcast I ever went on, ever, was the Sports Wonderkin podcast. You know, kind of popped my cherry there with you, Coleman. And I think I want to say for sure we did, like, a mock, like, rookie draft of the 2013, like, rookie class.
I mean, if you go on YouTube right now, all of our old shows are on YouTube because that's how we used to record. So, like, if you go to my old, like, skateboarding YouTube channel, all of those Sports Wonderkin casts are on there because we recorded on Google Hangouts. Because when Coleman and I started making podcasts, this was before, like, you could get Skype call recorders. This was before Zoom existed. This was 5 years before Zencastr. And it's really just a gigantic branding error for me because I had a podcast, a fantasy football podcast that existed at this point, like, I think 7 years ago, that had, like, some listeners, had a website, had, like, iTunes reviews, and I just bailed on it, just deleted it.
It had scouting profiles. Like, there was Davis Maddox scouting profiles on Marcus Wilson, a legit Marcus Wilson scouting profile.
There was
that was written up in the Wonderkin.
There was a lot, dude. Like, Coleman and I remember the whatever NFL draft where Tavon went, however many, so that was 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that NFL draft, Coleman and I live blogged it on the website where we were, like, posting instant reactions like we were on RotoViz or something. Like, we were just, like, writing up immediate reactions to these fantasy relevant picks. Like, and this was for no money. Like, I didn't have advertising on that site. No one was paying me. I don't think I made any money. I don't think I got any referrals. Maybe some FanDuel referrals I got from that site. But, like, there was no money involved in grinding Sports Wonderkin.
Oh, it was so awesome, though. We had a blast at that shit. And, I mean, I'm not swearing this podcast. Are we doing free reign here?
Yeah.
No, I won't get too loose, but I'd make sure
I saw a great tweet the other day where it was like the most common uttered words by white guys in America now are, oh, I can swear on this podcast?
Yeah, I have to ask. I'm usually pretty good. You know, I have kids, so I'm good at, you know, holding myself down and knowing the proper forms. But whenever, you know, I think about our days of podcasting, every time I've talked to you, we just always talk so naturally, just as regular dudes. We're talking before the show, like, you're probably maybe one of a dozen dudes that I've got actually have your phone number, you know, in my phone.
Yeah, we're real life pals.
So, yeah, I mean, I remember doing the Wonderkin podcast, and that was where I first got on and started doing podcasts. And, you know, now I'm a little more seasoned. That's where I kind of found my footing, my voice, and just found it was natural, you know, not to be, you know, as rehearsed, and just to have conversations about football and players and stuff like that, and, you know, be prepared and, you know, to just have a good time with it. And it was a blast with you guys. I mean, pour one out for Coleman. I miss Coleman.
Who knows where he's up in these streets. Coleman _ FF, man.
He was, man. You guys were influential in getting me started there, and it played a big role in that. And then obviously getting me into RotoViz, where those early days of RotoViz, and, you know, Matt Friedman just wrote an article about, like, kind of his life journey to where he got so far. It was a really good article. And he was kind of harping on some of those early days of RotoViz. And it kind of just, you know, brought a flicker back in my soul of just how we used to have just these epic email chains where just all of us just made each other so much better at fantasy football and, like, evaluating stuff. And, of course, like the Barnum and Bailey, Frank DuPont fantasy douche. I mean, you know, who's kind of – I missed Douche so much. I missed him more, a little more than Coleman. Sorry, Coleman. But no, I wish Douche was back, man.
Such a ledge. Like, that guy,
I mean, oh, he was so big.
People now have no idea. They don't, like, if you just got into fantasy football 2 years ago, RotoViz is, like, just another site to you. And, like, every fantasy football website does numbers-based content now. Like, your content will not exist if you don't even pretend to have, like, proprietary metrics and, like, things like that. But, like, literally every single fantasy football article now probably has the concept of, like, volume being more important than talent and stuff. And that's just, like, a total given. And I won't say RotoViz invented that, because I don't think they did, but they 100% popularized it in the space. Because, like, when RotoViz began, there was, like, nothing but blowback for it. Like, people did not like it when it started.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, everyone is wrong for the Holy Wars, you know, film versus metrics. And now it's kind of accepted that both are applicable. And then it kind of turned into, you know, the whole wide receiver, the war of, like, the large wide receiver versus the small wide receiver. That was, like, the Tavon year, basically, is what started that, because the team traded up for Tavon Austin and, you know, drafted him. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it was crazy. You know, I think about, like, those days and how long ago it feels, just because of how much work I've done since then. But how influential, like you said, breaking that podcast, you know, cherry, and getting all that under my belt, and having to work under a guy like, you know, Frank, who we obviously know at this point that his name is not Frank DuPont. I want to know how many people truly know him. I mean, I feel like there's a handful. I'm not one of them.
I'm not either. And I was the first, like, six guys to write on. I think my, like, there was some Ravens running back that I, like, wrote an article about that was, like, I think the fifth article ever on RotoViz. And, like, I'm sure if you go back and read it now, all my RotoViz articles are not very good. Other than
Who's the worst player you wrote an article on at RotoViz?
Oh, I mean, this, like, who could ever say? Like, there's some Aaron Mellett takes out there. You know what? I'm gonna go look at my RotoViz author page right now. But
we wrote about some dives, man. We were digging deep on dudes. I wrote an article, I think, on Gerald Robinson, this dude that was a converted wide receiver that was a tight end for the Broncos. Had, like, good metrics. He went to Arizona State. I wrote about Chris Matthews when he came from what league was he in before this? He wasn't in the CFL, was he? He wasn't in the CFL. And then he came over to the Seahawks. And then in this – because I remember someone deliberately tweeting RotoViz during the Super Bowl when he went off against the Patriots. And they're like, I know you guys got a Chris Matthews article. And I was like, yeah, I got you. And, like, it happened. We wrote about, man, so many garbage dudes.
So I'm just gonna read off some of, like, so the last article I wrote for RotoViz was in 2014, so literally 4 years ago. And I'm just gonna read off some article titles for you. On Marquise Colston, Brandon Cooks, and Nick Toon's Wyatt Storm upside. John Grimes, Texans backup and a goal-score superstar. Ladarius Green wants you to win fantasy football championships. Oh, here's a good one. Is Travis Kelce your tight end lottery ticket?
He is. We got a winner there.
We got a Johnny Manziel screaming bargain article. Our old boy for the Colts, Derek Rogers.
Oh, yeah.
Man, these are some bad players. These are some bad players that are in here. Man, I used to write a lot about fantasy football.
No, you were, I mean, you were way in the way ahead of before I was.
I'll be honest with you, it just, for me, I reached my ceiling in the space of just writing about like deep dynasty sort of things. Like my skill set was never really suited to that. Really, the big thing is that I just idolized the shit out of Sean, and I just wanted to be like Sean. And so that was why I just got so into fantasy football writing at that time.
He's easy one to hook you into with the ideas he had around that time. And obviously, like I said, being in those email threads where all of us were able to share. I mean, you look at the alumni now that came from that group. And I was in the initial fledgling, like the starting like nucleus. But, I mean, when you think of all the guys, like, you know, Sean was there, you were there, Friedman was there, Bales. John Moore, Sal wrote a little bit there. You know, I was there. I mean, that's
People don't know that, like, John Bales is, like a millionaire, like, with Fantasy Labs now. That dude used to just, like, be, like, a self-employed Dallas Cowboys beat writer who contributed. Like, I used to do aggregated projections via email with Jonathan Bales when I was in college.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bales is a super cool dude, too.
He is. Also, just letting everyone know, my best ball championship draft just started on draft right now. I signed up for it way before the show started, but it just didn't fill. So that's going to be something that we're dealing with right now. But I want to get into before the RotoViz even. Why football for you? Why football compared to other stuff?
Well, I think as it pertains just from a fantasy sense, like a lot of numbers-based football fantasy guys now. I was someone who was just far more like a fantasy baseball gamer. I play a lot of fantasy baseball. You know, fantasy baseball is one of those games that just invokes so much of what we try to preach in these streets, what we're trying to do through RotoViz and what we do now through a lot of the content, which is, you know, about the process, you know, playing probabilities, having patience to see those decisions through, you know, when it comes down to winning leagues and having longevity and success and winning, you know, fantasy period, you know, whether that be, you know, DFS or anything like that. I mean, we all know that like your blind grandma can win a fantasy football league in a vacuum, but not many people can win fantasy baseball leagues on accident or can sustain like, you know, any marginal
if you've ever played serious fantasy baseball, that's a whole different game.
Yeah, but that's also what kind of made it, like, over time less appealing to me and, like, made it really mundane. I mean, it made like, games and actual stretches of real baseball just not matter at all. Like, really. I mean, where everything in football, like, every little thing in football, like, greatly impacts the outcome of that week, that season. All of it just matters so much. So attempting to solve, like, just that one side of the Rubik's Cube, like, offers just a more of a challenge and much rewarding experience and like also a lot more tilts, as anyone can, you know, attest to. I mean, there may not be a holy grail like ever for fantasy football analysis, and because the skeleton key we all chase is probably a complete MacGuffin. But the never ending pursuit, that just means like there's a plethora of stones that we still have to overturn this game, which I think you've seen over like the past 5 years of analysis. We talked about where like RotoViz started off and the things we are covering and where things are now and things that are just accepted for norm, even amongst the people that fought against stuff like that. And two is, as long as that happens, I mean, I get to stay employed.
You know, the big edge in fantasy football is that one, it's impossible to be great at it, I think. And two, it's a moving target like every 3 years.
Yeah.
Enough rules change, enough talent distribution changes, enough things happen in the course of the NFL that like you can come back to it 3 years later and it's like unrecognizable to you. That's I think why people love fantasy football so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were kind of, we went through that big period where the wide receivers like boomed. We probably hit an apex. Now we have the question, what happened last year?
Yeah, wide receivers were.
Did we reach an offensive? Yeah, we have to question, did we reach like an offensive apex? I mean, when you look at like all the production last year and like what happened in totality of the NFL last year, I mean, we had 108 fewer receiving and rushing touchdowns last year than the year before. Was that just because we flatlined, like we finally reached as far as it could go and like there was the recoil? Was it because, like you said, the rules changes? Is it because the distribution of NFL talent now is starting to shift more towards where the running backs are more talented, the premier running backs are more talented than the premier receivers? Was it all the quarterback injuries? I mean, we can go on and on and try to pick out of our favorite things, but I mean, we saw scoring.
I have a theory.
Like, drop it on us.
Well, and I've talked about this on a couple shows, but there is like a more optimal way to play football in terms of the math of it, which is that like passes are just worth more than rushing yards.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like that's just straight up true. But a lot of these short passing kind of West Coast style offenses, these teams are just not very good at it. Like they don't have the personnel to succeed, and the coaches don't know, you know, the proper route combinations. Like they're just not drawing things up correctly. Like
asking, Mike Shula.
Yeah. Like, and so I just think overall that's going to generate less points. And also another thing that I would add to that is if all of your opponents are playing the same way, it's a lot easier to, you're not having to change your game plan a ton week to week.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, that's what makes it great, though. I mean, I think before, like, just in the life stance, like, I kind of just accidentally fell into this. I was just, like, a gamer, like a lot of people. And I was working, you know, I just started full-time doing this as a job, as my lone source of income a year ago. Basically, almost a little, it was Memorial Day last year is when I accepted the job at NBC. And, you know, I was with a hydraulic seal company where I was a production manager for 13 years. And, you know, I kind of left it. It was a tough decision, man, to say, you know, at age 35, like, I'm just going to do fantasy sports. You know, it's different. I always joke with you when I used to do this podcast with you guys when you're younger. And I was like, man, I wish I was so much younger when we found this. Because we're thinking this is 5 years ago. I was entrenched in, like, a job and life at this point when I'm doing this podcast with you guys. And I was like, you know, I was jealous of you guys, man. I was like, man, I wish this was around, you know, like, a, you know, I would fall right into this.
Coleman bailed. He's like a librarian now. Like,
yeah, he said, screw it, man. He saw me and he's like, I can't let this happen. I gotta find something else. But yeah, I mean, it was tough to say, you know, at that point, you know, to just say like, listen, babe, we got this new house, we got these three kids. I'm just going to do fantasy sports. I don't know how long it'll last. I'm just going to do it.
Sure.
And, you know, like, yeah, it was a tough decision, but yeah, it's one of those things that those old tropes in life of, you know, it really matters, like doing something you like and, you know, finding something that you surround with people that push you to do better at your job. You know, I don't know how long this will last. I may be fired by NBC in a year or two, given that that's how the nature of these things work. But I mean, I also could have been, you know, going to a job 3 years from now that like I really had no desire to go to, and, you know, just see it kind of pushing the button on life. So I mean, one of those things that just kind of worked out in a way where I just struck with iron was hot, man. I was in at the right time. If I would have started now, and we, you know, we can get into some of the things that where people are looking now, because that's kind of been like a theme for people, I guess, the past week on Twitter and stuff. You know, I saw Kitchen tweeting about it, and, you know, people, Raybon and like guys trying to get into the field now of how to differentiate themselves. But, you know, I don't know what I would do right now. It was a lot different even 5 years ago. Like it was a lot easier still to get in.
I mean, I would say right now, if you're trying to get in, just don't. I mean, honestly, like how many guys can possibly have a fantasy football podcast? Like,
oh, everyone, man. And I'm notorious. Like I don't I've told people this before, like I don't listen to fantasy football podcasts. I barely read.
I listen to JJ's. That's it.
Yeah. JJ's got a good one. I mean, I mean, JJ's my boy and I still don't even listen to every episode of that. It's a great show though. I would definitely recommend people to listen to it.
I would rather listen to, like, this is actually a great topic, but, like, pretty much every time someone comes on, I ask them about the other podcast they listen to. I listen to soccer podcasts and gambling podcasts and CFL podcasts. Like, I would listen to all that stuff before. I actually low-key love the CFL. That's not even a joke. I'm into it. But
this is an old Manziel. Yeah, Manziel now, so.
Not even starting, though. Not even starting.
Still though, it's just a matter of time.
So, what other podcasts do you listen to?
Yeah. So, like I said, like football consumes so much of my life that, and I have so many other things that I'm interested in that I just can't. I don't have time for fantasy football podcasts because I spend so much time in the fantasy football world already. I just don't really like gravitate to listening to a lot of that stuff. And a lot of them are takes that like I already have. Like, you know, it's like most of the podcasts are very similar. And even the ones that go on, I answer similar questions when I go on. That's no offense to any shows I've been on. That's just how the nature of these works.
I mean, how many different ways can you break down ADP in July? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's June, July. And also, like, this is also the worst time for fantasy football. I talk about it. The summer is the worst time for fantasy football because it's the part that really matters less. We have nothing else to talk about for 3 months except for the air quotes winning your draft. like you have to win your draft. It means like winning your draft doesn't mean shit, man. Like, you know, like grading your draft and like going back, like go back and look at all your teams that did well last year, the teams that did well in your league, and like think about what those teams were.
The answer
on, like,
is my teams didn't do that well last year because I had David Johnson and Ty Montgomery in the first three rounds in every league. Like I took David Johnson first overall in three different leagues.
But you were taking David Johnson, to your credit, the year before first overall too, and that worked out great. So
I mean, I take him first overall this year too. He's the best.
There you go, man.
He's David Johnson. We don't even really do fantasy takes on this podcast, but he is the best offensive player in the NFL. I mean, Antonio Brown is also very good, but he just only does it in one way. David Johnson runs and catches passes, so therefore he's better to me.
Yeah, he used to return kicks his rookie year too. He definitely has at least one cookie.
His first touch in the NFL was a touchdown against the Saints. He won a game.
Yep, absolutely. But cycling back. You know, I listen to more like pop culture podcasts. I mean, I'm huge into movies. So I used to do a Blank Check podcast. That's for like a David Sims, who's like a movie reviewer and like an actor. Griffin Newman, like they host that, and they just like do a podcast. I really like that podcast a lot. They just kind of like riff on different movies and like different directors that have had like blank checks given to their careers and like how their careers subsequently play out like after that and how their movies go. But yeah, other than that, just like mostly all pop culture stuff, you know. I used to listen to Nerdist. It turns out he turns out Chris Hardwick was a scumbag. So we had to drop that. And we'll probably never hear it again.
I don't like if a podcast is on the front page of iTunes, I probably never listen to it. The only one that I listen to that's like a very popular podcast is How Stuff Works.
Yeah, I've been listening to basically Hardwick is basically replaced by Dax Shepard now. So like his podcast like has basically replaced that, like kind of cycled in. He gets good guests and it's just natural, just conversations. So I don't like when the pop culture people come to promote stuff, I want to hear them just talk about stuff, you know, in the journey and things about their life. Stuff like that's way more interesting to me than, you know, like I said, just the promotion of Rampage, whatever Dwayne Johnson movie's got coming out this week. I mean, Dwayne Johnson's in seemingly every movie, like known to man. I'm pretty sure that he's basically in every build summer movie at this point.
The guy's a ledge.
I mean, he's the way to do it, man. He turned himself into he's basically the modern day Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like that would have been the path.
You would really like this show called 30-20-10, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's just like pop culture jokes and reviews of shit from 30, 20, and 10 years ago.
Yeah, I'm all for that.
It actually would be like right up your alley. Not that like anyone in the world needs to listen to more podcasts. Like there was something I had to realize when I started doing this show is I was like, no one really wants to listen to another podcast. Like everyone has enough podcasts. This is a vanity project for me, basically.
I mean, I assumed all your projects are vanity projects. To this point of knowing you, so I mean,
like I have a real job now. I don't need this podcast for money. Like any advertising or whatever that's done on this is done. So like I can like go out to eat more often, basically, or like place more tennis bets. Like that's the only reason.
And I mean, no one can see you right now because you say you don't use the video for these, but you've got a real sharp tennis look going on right now too.
Well, I have not cut my hair in at this point like 2 years.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, there's just no point.
there's just no point.
Well, you know, if you're a man, like, probably not for you, but all of my friends go and get their hair cut, like, once every 3 weeks, and it's not cheap. Like, they're paying $30 for some, like, forearm tattoo guy to cut their hair. Like,
I would say people pay even more than that, a lot of people now.
Women pay way more. I know a woman's haircut is like $200. That's not even a joke. Like it's insane.
I would wager that Denny Carter pays upwards of $60-$70 for haircut. We need to. I'm gonna have to text him after this and ask him.
Text him right now. He definitely owns the libs by paying $80 for a haircut, and he tips too. I'm certain of it.
Definitely. I'll hit him up while we're doing this and see what he says.
I really hope that he gets back. So let's try and have an intelligent conversation. What is something that you believe about the game of football that other people don't believe, or conversely, something that everyone believes about the game of football that you think is bad and stupid?
Well, I think it's a mix of both, and it's the NFL draft, man. I think the NFL draft is basically a crock of shit just on a lot of levels. You know, one, how it's – first, obviously, nobody is good at drafting. Nobody admits and accounts to being bad at drafting, and nearly every claim of a team being good or, like, a personnel department being good at drafting is centered around, like, them walking backwards into a pile of gold and having – any true concept or adequate process of that, like, doesn't really exist. And it's usually washed away very quickly, kind of like Seahawks fans are finding out right now.
The Seahawks, are the New York Giants West at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the Seahawks were a team, like, listen, they got lucky. And a lot of people, like, saluted the way they went about things by acquiring more draft picks. But the way to acquire – the NFL draft isn't about just having extra bullets in the chamber. It's about having extra, like, bullets, like, in the rounds that matter. And, like, the Seahawks are a team that just, like, acquired a bunch of, like, fifth through seventh round picks.
Do you remember when your San Francisco 49ers had that draft where they drafted all the injured guys and everyone was like, this is genius?
God. Dude, Trent Baalke, like, that's another dude. Like I said, he's another one of these dudes that, like, the wool gets pulled over people's eyes for, like, the short-term success, and you don't just realize how, like, terrible the process is for these guys. But, like, the Seahawks are team, like, all they did was acquire a bunch of fifth through seventh round picks for a longest time. They weren't even using draft capital, like, their premier draft capital. I think they've only made, like, two first-round picks over the past 5 years, and one was on an offensive guard, and the one was this year on a running back. Like, they're terrible. Like, they're pretty bad at this. Like, they just, like, ran into some luck. Like, hit a third-round quarterback, the gold mine. You know, you get one of those, so you got pretty much free reign. But then they hit, like, other guys, like Richard Sherman. Like, finding an elite cornerback, like, with, like, that kind of draft capital is, like, pretty rare as well. So, I mean, they hit that, like, lottery ticket. So, I mean, they just had a bunch of lottery tickets. But you've seen – so they've acquired all these draft picks, but in the low-leverage rounds. And, like, these are guys that don't even make their team. Like, because they're just dudes. They just, like, throw a bunch of dudes at the wall, and, like, half of these guys, they don't make the team, and they go be somewhere decent elsewhere, like an Alex Collins or, you know, even like a Spencer Ware or some of these other guys. But yeah, I mean, like, just no one's good at this though. And I think my biggest problem with, like, the NFL draft is, like, we would be fine with it if it was just accepted that, like, everyone is bad at it. But the NFL, the way the draft is covered by NFL teams, the way it's covered by NFL draft scouts. My job is not important. Like, being, like, a fantasy football analyst is completely not important, but, like, if there's something worse than it, it's like being, like, a draft analyst. Like, analyst.
What about the guy who like, has NFL in his Twitter handle and is, like, tweeting screen grabs of, like D3 QB film? That guy has
– You see
that
him?
That guy has the – I do see him. You want to know a brutal thing, though, about seeing him is Sammy Watkins is going to have the best year of his career this year. He's going to actually be good, but he's not going to be good. He's just going to have good fantasy stats, and it's going to really bum me out.
Yeah, but, like, I think that we would be okay with all these things if the NFL didn't operate under, like, this large umbrella of hubris, like, during, like, the draft period. And in turn, like, all of their hubris then trickles down and is sold as, like, this sack of magic beans to deranged tribalistic lemmings that believe that their team did not draft poorly or, like, operates, like, under all this hubris themselves. You know, like, how often do you see, like every, if you follow a team's fan base and you, or if you are a fan of an NFL team, like, every time your team makes a pick, there's a dude, like, defending that pick, whether it be, like, a scout, and then that's getting retweeted. You know, or you, like, everyone's talking about their fifth round inside linebacker and, like, how this was a great pick. And, like, no one talks, like, how, like, one, the success rate of those players at that position of the draft or that position or, like, bringing player age. And none of this stuff is even talked about. But, like, every team is discussed under the umbrella. Like, all these draft picks were not made with air when, like, literally if you get one of these, like, seven picks right, if you have seven, like, you're already in, like, good position. But, you know, all that stuff has just trickled down to the fans now as well. So, like, the whole way that the draft is just presented, consumed, endorsed is just such a lie on every level. And it's such big. The draft is so big NFL. That's the most NFL thing we have. I mean, do you even know, like, do people even know there is, like, a baseball draft? Like, people even know there's a Major League Baseball draft?
People, like, know, but, like, imagine how that's, like, the dumbest thing that exists.
Yeah. But the NFL, like, has this, though. I will say, though, one thing that the NFL draft like is slowly coming around upon, and I think it's because it's an accident. They fell into this because of their own like terrible rules that they had to institute. I don't know if they're necessarily terrible rules, but all it did was like siphon money from rookies and give them to like mediocre quarterbacks. That's like what the rookie wage scale did. It's like, oh, like instead of like rookie Sam Bradford making $50 million, it's just Andy Dalton making $50 million. So it's like, you know, six or one half. Like where this right. happened isn't like trickled money down to like, you know, other important players. But like, the way NFL age is like it's slowly starting to come around, but it's still like the most important thing that I don't think like everybody is really being looked at under like through the right lens. I think the reason why teams are drafting younger is just because college players now don't have the incentive they do to stay like and elevate their draft stock. So now like good players come out earlier because it's just rookie wage scale. I mean, if you're a good player ready to come to the league, you just do it. It's kind of arbitrary and crude, but if you look at like over the past decade. So 28% of the draft picks over the past decade, 20 or 21 years old, have already made a Pro Bowl in their careers. For all other ages afterwards, it's just 19.3%. And I mean, in terms of the best players in the league, they're truly like difference makers for a franchise. Mm-hmm. Just two players drafted over the past decade of 24 years or older have ever been on an All-Pro team. Just two.
Yeah, that's legit actionable information.
Sean Lee and Kyle Long are the only two guys. And I know that there are a lot more players being drafted in the other buckets of ages that kind of hurt like those player rates. But on per pick level, if you look at like the approximate value, which is a metric created by Doug Durin of Pro Football Reference, it's kind of like one of the few things we have where like people are trying to like – trying to delineate like what like war would be for, like over the course of a season, you know, or like give value to like players based on like their position and like draft stock and stuff like that. On a per player level, it completely rises per like as age elevates. So if you look at like the average approximate value of a player 24 years older, it's just 6.6, and it goes to 9.5 at age 23, 11.9 at age 22, and it spikes to 17.3 at age 21. You know, and it's really just blatantly simple and inherent. It's just, we just kind of ignore it. It's that good players produce early on and therefore leave amateur sports and go into the professional level. And they're doing that more now. So underclassmen are declaring more now so than ever because of that rookie wage scale and implementation of that.
It's so obvious, but even at that level, like you take two wide receivers who are like equally productive in college and you're flipping coins between who's actually going to be good in the NFL or not. Cause there's so many variables.
Oh, did I lose you? Oh, did I lose you for a second? I thought I lost you. I spiked for a second.
No, we're good. sometimes these connections get weird.
That's good. Good podcasting there. It's like, but you're right. And like, I mean, older prospects are just generally guys that on an even trajectory just haven't produced, and they produce when they're, you know, older and more like have a lot more experience than the guys that they are at an amateur level. And I think that if you're looking for like old guys, like success rates, I mean, for like different figures, it's like you're looking for the guys from the smaller schools that just weren't afforded the path to come to the NFL early on. You know, I mean, you think when you look at guys like John Brown and Cooper Kupp or like Tony Romo, those were guys
Tony Romo.
Yeah, because those were guys that just were in a school and didn't have like a position to like have light shine on them to go to the NFL earlier. And maybe we're starting to see that shift. I mean, last year we had a guy, Adam Shaheen, declare from D2 Ashland University early. And like, yeah, that's pretty rare.
And then start in the NFL.
It's pretty rare to, one, have a D2 guy go in the second round, but have an underclassman D2 guy go because, you know, the league told him it was okay. Like, the league said, like, you're going to go in, like, this set area. I mean, that's what made his decision, you know, impacted his decision. But, yeah, it's so obvious, you know, player age, but it's hardly incorporated, you know, on the level of, you know, player versus player basis on what the decisions these teams make within the positions and where they, you know, allocate their draft capital, where they spend, and how teams draft. I mean, you look at like a guy like the Ravens are notorious not only through the draft, but through free agency. How many years are we going to watch the Ravens try to rebuild their receiving core through these washed receivers?
You don't think the John Brown deal is good?
I mean, I think it's fine, but like,
no,
this is
not.
Like,
it's not.
I mean,
here's a tip, NFL teams. If a player has chronic injury problems, just don't pay him. Don't play him, because there is another guy with John Brown's similar skill level who doesn't have what is it, sickle cell? Is that what John Brown has?
Yeah.
And I don't mean this to be insensitive or rude to him in any way, but it's just like football is probably the number one sport where I would say the most important thing is to have your body at peak physical shape as much as possible for as long as possible in a game. Maybe basketball is close, but even then, I think it's more of like a skill game. But like, I just think being healthy is such a skill in the NFL. Like, you just shouldn't sign old guys and you shouldn't sign hurt guys.
Yeah, that's good logic, and that's just good business. Like, we talk about, you know, all these procedures they have and trust the process. But we've watched the Ravens not only do this through free agency, try to just get old dudes. We saw it with Macklin, we saw it with Mike Wallace. You know, a couple times it's worked, like Bolden popped for him. They did it with Steve Smith, and he kind of rejuvenated himself for a couple years. That's like, this has been like their eternal process. I mean, they took Rashad Perriman the 1 year, and that didn't work out, but I mean, his hairline was old, so I mean, we can always say that. But they did, then this year they doubled down and they draft Hayden Hurst in the first round. Like, this guy's going to be 25 years old before he takes an NFL snap. Like, it's just unreal. And I understand that he played baseball, but it doesn't matter. This guy was, he didn't even do anything when he went back to college. And like, he wasn't even productive. Like, he wasn't even a guy putting up numbers and producing, you know, over these college kids that are 20 years old and 19 years old. You know, how are we supposed to expect this dude to come in the NFL and like hit the ground running? Like, it's just, it's insane that teams still don't like apply this type of simple logic. I mean, maybe in like the sixth or seventh round, you're making some of these decisions, but we were talking about taking the tight end, making him the tight end one overall in the class. Like, this is insane to me. Like, how does your process like arrive, like just get you to that point?
The cocoon, man. That's why.
True. It's really honest. It all comes back to the cocoon.
The biggest thing that people don't realize about football is that there are so many players involved, and it's such a weird game in terms of like probabilities that a lot of it is just total variance. Like, there for fantasy, it's a little bit less because offenses tend to you know, play the same sort of players and call similar styles of plays. But in terms of who wins or loses games, who wins or loses in the playoffs, who wins or loses the Super Bowl, I mean, it's probably the only league I can think of in American sports where like 20 teams are like viable championship contenders at the start of the year.
Yeah, I think that's why so many people like it. It's what we talked about the intro to the show. And, you know, it's one of the great things we talk about, the cocoon, but that's what part of the reason what makes us that, you know, kind of deploy ourselves into this area like so good is that the NFL doesn't change. You know, so we won't have these teams that go out and do what the Eagles did last year, and we don't have these teams typically like the Patriots that go to attack teams' weaknesses and, you know, evolve their weekly game plan around those things. All of the NFL teams just do the same. They do that vice versa. We're going to make this team stop us, what we do. And it, like, that's how all of the league coaches basically, and that's why it's easier for us from a fantasy sense to highlight these players from an offensive level and try to hone in on like some of that, you know, where the variance gets shrunk down. So we know what teams are going to do even when it's not working.
Right. Which creates an edge in a lot of different ways, but also, I mean, it's definitely something that it's kind of, that idea is kind of in the forefront right now because everyone's so mad about the NBA. Like, everyone's so mad about how good the Warriors are.
They're mad at the NBA for being the same NBA it's been for the history of the NBA.
Yeah. And I just don't actually, for me personally, I think because like you, I'm a gamer. I tend to view things through the lens of like probability. And I'm not saying that I'm sharp, because I'm not. If you're trying to listen to a sharp guy give takes, you're listening to the wrong podcast. But like, I tend to view things in terms of like, well, if the most likely thing happens a considerable amount of the time, I'm going to like that thing. I've been playing tennis DFS for like this week. And like, one of the nicest things is like the outcomes are like mega predictable. So a lot of it is about just like figuring out what those most likely things are. And something I don't like about the NFL is how the most likely outcome can a lot of the times be like a plurality. So it's like a 34% thing is the most likely thing. For me, that's kind of a brutal thing to make me with.
Yeah. I mean, all the correlations we talk about from a fantasy sense too, even the hard hitting correlations, you know, when we talk about just like yearly rollover from like team level, is like completions. And that's like, you know, basically 43% of this year's NFL team's completions can explain by how many passes they completed last year. Like that's not great. It's not a great correlation. Like when you think about, you know, actual percentages that go into creating what we can explain for the following season. And even like targets on a per level basis is a little over 50%. And that's the highest we've got to like roll over. This just, the correlations aren't strong. That's why I said that we're circling back in the front. That's like, oh, makes it so fun and makes it such a game that we want to, you know, to hone in on. And it's so rewarding when we do experience success in.
It is. Winning in fantasy football feels better than winning in anything else. I'm very much a believer in that. And also, I just took Jared Cook in my draft because I just got stuck in the middle of this. So, you know, maybe I won't be winning. This team is pretty brutal. But what are you gonna do?
And the best thing about fantasy football too is that the majority of the time it is, and a lot of analysts won't cop to this, but I mean, it's one thing that kind of the school of douche installed in us very early on is that like most of the time when we're right for such the wrong stuff. Like,
oh,
it's
sure.
Unbelievable. Like I can remember like one time, like I remember just pimping Matt Jones versus the Saints so hard. I think it was like in 2015 when like he had lost the starting job and like kind of was like getting it back. And I was like, you know, this is the week, like, you got to play Matt Jones. He's so cheap in DFS. Like, he's so undervalued. Like, the Saints are horrible. Like, he's getting this job back. He's come off like a season high workload and like market share. Like, he's going to have all these rushing carries against this team that's terrible. And like, the Redskins will probably score more points because it's the Saints. Like, it's going to be great. And the Redskins like dusted the Saints. They beat them like 48-13 or something crazy. Matt Jones got out touched by Alfred Morris like 20-12. But like Matt Jones had like an 80-yard screen pass for a touchdown. He had like 130 receiving yards in the game. Caught three passes for 130. Yeah, and like, but I touted him. So like, I remember it was like Draft Day Consultants, and like they tweeted out like, "Yeah, you should listen to like Lord Reeves for tweeting this out." And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, man, that was some bullshit. But I mean, I played him in all these leagues. So I'm super happy. Like, I play a ton of him and he pops. Like, and like, whatever. But it was like, it was totally for none of the right reasons. But like, it was one of my most profitable weeks playing. And it was just, you know, it was just crazy, man. That's how the NFL is. Like, we're very rarely right for the right reasons.
No. Like, the amount of times that you're going to get like the coaching and the talent and the matchup, like, exactly right. It's just such a low percentage of the time, which is wild. And I actually do think that's why people like it so much, is because getting something right in football feels great. It just feels amazing to be like, yep, called it.
Yeah, I think that's why, like, that's part of the issue. I have such a issue with, like, the rankings and projections and how it's – fantasy football has become, like, themed around those two things, like, forever. It's like the linchpin. And it's not fantasy pros' fault. I get what fantasy pros and their angle and everything, but like, so much is centered around like where like dudes rank in fantasy pros. But like, it's just it's like, we're talking like it from like a free throw shooting perspective, like everyone's still bad at it. But it's like the way it's framed is just like, it's just such like where everyone chases to be like that right 60% of the time. It's crazy, like the pursuit of that angle.
It is. And I mean, that's kind of something that drifted me away from the seasonal game. Also, the seasonal game is like a lot of work, and I'm like an idiot millennial with like a 5-second brain. So like when DFS for me was like the galaxy brain meme. Like, watching football was regular brain, seasonal fantasy football was like the slightly expanded brain, and then daily fantasy was the galaxy brain. And like, I find so much more reward and joy, and like, I just get so focused in on DFS, and now seasonal for me matters less. I have one league that I mega care about, which is my league with all my like high school and college buddies that I've never won, that I just get like, I'm just egregious at it, and they give me shit so, just the most amount you could ever get. Like, these guys are drafting quarterbacks in the fourth round still. Like, it does not matter. And, you know, four running backs in a row, just whatever. And I just get wrecked by them. Like, I've made the playoffs, I think, three times. Like, it's just brutal.
My only experience has definitely dramatically shifted over the past few years because, you know, every time I lose a game or anytime it's something like that, it's instantly thrown in my face based on what I do now. So that adds like a great new element to like the home leagues. But I mean, seasonal leagues, there's no doubt, like from an EV stance, they're by far like the most negative way to play fantasy football. But it's the part of things that draw, like you said, like a lot of people still. The general population of fantasy football still played under that same bucket umbrella that you just described, still playing with their friends, still playing with people they know and grew up with. You've got these home league drafts that are events where people come in from out of town and they're live. You get to check in with friends. I have one that I do with a buddy that lives in Florida. It's the only time I see him every year, basically, and it's a blast, catch up. And that's why season league still probably will never – it'll be a while before it's certainly overcome from the gen pop angle of people like kind of moving on to DFS, even as popular as it's grown. But yeah, I mean, those seasonal leagues, I still play a ton, probably more than I should, but there's no doubt that it is the most negative EV fantasy football experience.
How many will you play this year?
I still do like a dozen. I do a bunch of home leagues still that I just am not willing to give up. I mean, I do one with my father-in-law where these guys, man, I mean, they don't even know what I do still at this point. I've been it for like a decade. Like they, you know, it's yeah. Amazing. Like ever since I married into the family and like got like brought into this league, they still don't even know like who I am. It's like these dudes don't like buy magazines. They just like play fantasy football. It's like the worst scoring ever too, but like you just adjust. Like I'm not someone that really, I used to like when I first started playing fantasy football, I used to be like all up in arms about scoring. Like I'm never going to play in a league. This is so dumb. But like you really just, if you're good at fantasy, you just adjust what the scoring is and you go from there.
I had the same experience too. Like my, it was like a legit battle to get the guys in my league to do PPR at all, and we settled on half point PPR. That was the furthest they were willing to go, and it's like, and then I just stopped caring.
Yeah, I used to do that like in my leagues when I was younger, and like, you know, black flag and try to like, you guys are doing this all wrong, we should do this. And I was like thinking, I was like, wait, this is like where I get the edge, like it's cool, I can take advantage of this now. And like this, so this league started, like my father-in-law runs this league, and it's like they used to do it out of the newspaper, so all touchdowns are five just for additional purposes. And I don't know what adding fives instead of sixes is that much different, but they like all touchdowns are five, and there's like bonus scoring for long touchdowns and like all kinds of stuff, and it's just wild, man. And but none of these dudes like pay attention, they don't even care. I'm just like a person in that league, and it's just a ton of fun. But it's been a cash cow over the years. Like the guy sends like a yearly like update of like running money, and I've been in it for a decade. I'm like second on the list of like this 30-year league. My father-in-law is like 40th, and like I just always rub it in his face. But there's just some I won't give up just because those are like difference makers in like your percentages. You know, we talk about I'm gonna play like maybe a dozen. I've got 13 dynasty leagues, I'm doing a bunch of these best ball leagues. I'm someone who's just trying to create an edge in fantasy football. There, like I said, there's no skeleton key. It's MacGuffin. But if I can turn my initial 8% odds into creating an edge where I have like 12 to 15% odds, and I can play in enough leagues where that makes a difference for my investment, then that's where it's acceptable to me. It's these people, like, it's hard for me to play in just like five or six leagues. So I'm going to do that. If I'm going to play, like if I'm going to do redraft, I'm not just going to do a couple leagues. Like I'm just going to do a bunch because I want to make it worthwhile for my investment. Like, you know, for the Annies.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Let's track away from fantasy, get back to some real stuff, or try to at least, before we do some pop culture. But so Josh Hermsmeyer, he and I definitely don't agree on Bitcoin, but he's been really hammering this idea that I think goes along with the conversation we were just having, which is that coaching actually matters way more than anyone wants to give it credit for, but like play calling and just, you know, kind of what you're asking your players to do and, you know, going for it on fourth down, punting, is like all of that stuff matters way more to winning and losing games than like individual player skill than anyone on TV, you know, in punditry or even really in our community wants to give it credit for. And I actually kind of think he's right. I think that the spectrum of coaching in football is wider than in any other sport that exists in the world. And the head coach and the offensive coordinator and the defensive coordinator have more direct impact on the outcome of games than in any other sport. And I now firmly believe that is fact.
Yeah, I think it just depends on how you're trying to frame the concept of where coaching matters. I think if that's the framework, like that's 100% correct. And not even recency bias, you know, of, you know, obviously the Eagles and what they did last year with what they did on fourth downs and, you know, trick plays, not caring about running backs, you know, the way they ran their team, you know, having a large defensive lineman to rotate that are good at rushing the quarterback, all these things that we know inherently matter in football. They did all those things. And that's how you're able to capitalize. And, you know, they were able to cash in, even if they wouldn't have cashed in, I still would. But like, obviously it was a success and they're going to be set up to be successful under Doug Peterson. If that's the way they continue to build their roster, coach games and, handle the way their personnel is on the football field, they're going to be fine. Even if that's the only Super Bowl they win, like having success still, like it's hard to win a Super Bowl. We talked about it.
It's very hard.
Yeah. So, I mean, if they don't win it again, I think it was a success and they'll continue to be a successful franchise because they're still ahead of that curve. I think where you get the lines blurred now is where you get the fantasy guys involved like us. And then the way you frame the coaching matters from a fantasy sense, if you're going to tell me Kyle Shanahan's fantasy tight ends have always sucked and don't draft George Kittle because all under that light, like that, there's a lot more context that needs to be applied there. And, you know, I was someone that came in and, you know, was I did a lot of this offensive coordinator stuff before a lot of these guys. You know, I was someone that like, went under the hood a lot of the stuff, and a lot of my early articles had, you know, stuff where I was looking at, you know, because I did a lot of game flow stuff early on. That was, like, stuff I did for RotoViz and, like, what coaches and what personnel, like, how they were just deploying targets and things like that and seeing rollover on that. I mean, it's just so hard to have the proper sample size to delegate that information properly. Like, you need a large sample size of a coach being successful through, like, a large disparity and variance of player talent, and that doesn't exist because the only guys that get or awarded a sample size of coaching in the NFL are, one, attached to player talent, and typically player talent at the quarterback position, and which opens up the whole other, you know, chicken or egg development of is it coaching or was it the quarterback to begin with for a lot of these guys, Mike McCarthy. But, you know,
I think that's the case for sure where it was the quarterback, but I think that the hashtag secret for quarterbacks right now is not every quarterback is built the same, and a lot of quarterbacks can be successful if they're Jared Goff, dude, like the arm talent was legit, and he wasn't great in college, but he was pretty good, and he was obviously horrific as a rookie, and then he gets a coach that's like smart and does the right things and you know has all sorts of innovative schemes, and all of a sudden the dude looks like Kurt Warner or whatever. And I think that could happen with, like, Mitch Trubisky, right? Like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of teams, like, obviously the Bears and the Titans are the two teams everyone is looking at for these teams that kind of didn't recircle the wagon on, you know, the coaching retreads and just kind of recycle what guys that have been in the league, in the cocoon, as Evan would say, where you brought up earlier. Like, those are the teams that are actually trying to move forward and try different things. And they have exciting personnel, too. You know, you look at what – you know, Mitch Trubisky no longer has to throw 24% of his passes to Kendall Wright this year. It'd be different if they brought in Matt Nagy and Mark Helfrich and they did the same personnel, but they actually did exciting things, like, personnel-wise. The Titans have exciting players, like players we already like and inherently know are talented to go with this team. So when you pair that type of marriage up, it's fine. Like, that's when we start to get excited. It's when you do the inversely, when you have guys that are retreads and you kind of just like, well, they're just going to do the same stuff they did at this place. Like, and you know, it doesn't matter how much we really like that player, they're going to do this and kind of run into that wall of coaching there. But I mean, like, bringing it back full circle, it all just depends on like how you're really trying to frame coaching matter and the application of it, you know, through like a real football lens and a fantasy lens. Cause I mean, it's still a lot harder to do that, you know, to what kind of actual impact the coach is having,
yeah, I mean, we're not inside the room, so that's tough.
Right, right. And it's harder. I think we have examples like we had with Goff last year. Like, it's a little more, like, brought to light. But it's going to be also interesting, too, like, the sustainability of a guy like Goff. I think I feel a lot more comfortable in a guy like Doug Peterson and where the Eagles excel and the way they coach their team than I do feel more a little about the excitement that maybe surrounds people, like a Sean McVay gives people. And I would be excited about Sean McVay, especially of what he did last year and how he was able to improve Goff. But, like, there's still a lot of sustainability question, I think, with how the Rams, you know, were able to efficiently perform that I think that we're questions about how the Eagles are going to be able to do it, because the Rams did it on such a hyper aggressive way than the Eagles did last year, you know, getting so many possessions in opponent's field territory that we know isn't going to roll over, you know, how many short touchdown passes they threw. You know, I always talk about, like, one of my favorite stats last year is Goff threw 8 touchdowns behind the line of scrimmage last year. You know, the next quarterback threw 3. He had 3 touchdown passes on passes over 15 yards downfield. There's a lot, like, more, like, ways where they're going to have to maintain hyper efficiency more than pure coaching. I think the Rams will than the Eagles will. It basically is what I'm saying. I think a lot more of the way the Eagles' philosophy is built isn't necessarily reliant on them remaining hyperly efficient, even though they were last year. Like I said, that hyper efficiency led them to the Super Bowl. Like, even if they're just like a consistent playoff team, a consistent winning team, like, that's success still. Whereas, you know, I think the Rams, like, still have a lot more. Like, we've seen a lot of teams come up like the Rams and do this, you know, whether it be the Cowboys the year before.
Yeah, they smash 1 year on, you know, some really good variants, some good game flow.
The Panthers the year before that, you know, So, I mean, I have a lot more questions just about the efficiency of how they did it and, you know, and that rolling over. But, yeah, I'm with you guys. I mean, I think it's worth seeing the concept. This is what we all want. We want the conversation of the NFL to move forward, and these guys like Doug Peterson. And hopefully Frank Reich's going to take some of what he learned from there and, like, a little bit of his stop there and, you know, move that over to the Colts, you know, a team that nobody wants to really invest in, but they've got some pieces that might be good. And if they're able to, like, just be, like, kind of like a bad team this year, but, like, do fun things on offense, like, there's guys that could pop at their, like, ADP for fantasy football. Definitely interesting. I mean, T.Y. Hilton's come just a year removed from leading the NFL in receiving yardage. I mean, they got guys like Nyheim Hines who is an exciting player. They've got, you know, some boring dudes like Jack Doyle, who's like a dad runner, like the ghost of Eric Ebron. Who, how fitting is it that Eric Ebron is, like, going to take over, like, what Kobe Fleener did? Like, is there a more fitting dude to, like, follow the footsteps of Kobe Fleener than Eric Ebron?
That's perfect. Like, you just put those two guys together, two guys who can't hold on to the football to save their lives.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just fun. Like, I'm glad that it's just, like, we had the success of those guys moving the conversation forward, and not just the guys that we had prior, though, because when the Cowboys had the success, it was basically them doing old school football, you know?
Yeah.
We're going to run the football a bunch. We've got offensive line. We invested a top 5 pick into this running back, you know, and it's going to work. Just watch us. And then it did work. And, you know, like I said, there's variance involved. And then last year it didn't work, you know, for more reasons than there was than just the variance coming away. It's just, it's hyper fragile to play the way the Cowboys want to play and, like, efficiently be good at it. And, like, a lot of people don't take that into account. And when you don't have a defense like the Jaguars, it's even harder to do, you know? So, I mean, there's just a lot of layers here that just still have to be unearthed. I don't think it's as black and white. I think it definitely matters, like Hermsmeyer says, and I definitely think it's overshot in the fantasy community, like some people do say as well. No, it was really long-winded, but whatever.
No, that's a good – this is a good transition, because before we get to pop culture stuff, I want to ask you, what is the thing that annoys you most about fantasy Twitter? I know what mine is, but I'm going to let you go first.
I mean, there's a few things that you just learn. I think the number one things you learn is – and I'm someone who, if you ever, like, read how I really got involved into, like, fantasy, I did a thing for the DLF, like, how I play, and kind of laid it out. Like, I was adamant against social media. I still don't have a Facebook to this day. I got no Gram account, no Snapchats, no nothing else. I'm not really someone that, like, cares. Like, I've got enough, like, stuff in my life. I don't need to tell you what I'm doing. And it's kind of, like, bled into, like, to Twitter a little bit. I mean, one, the thing is to remember is, like, you just don't have to tweet. Like, you don't have to tweet. I think a lot of people,
that's been a great lesson for me. Is not you? Like, every thought does not have to be tweeted.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be just like an updating thing on what you're doing. You just don't have to tweet. Like, a lot of people, I think, just, like, feel like they have to be out there on Twitter. So, like, they'll just tweet something, anything, get something out there. Just, you see the ABI, the handle, something, and, like, you just don't. You just don't have to. And, like, the extension of that is you don't have to reply. And that's a hard lesson, like, I think we've all learned. Like, I think
took me a long time. I was king of the Twitter war. Took me a long time. But now it's just, if someone annoys me now, they just get the mute. I can't.
Well, that's something that bothers me too. When you get into too. I mean, like that'll. I'll bring up a point three for that. But like, you just don't have to reply, and that goes into just like you don't have to tweet. Like, there's so much fantasy football saturation, and there's so much variance in fantasy football, and like we talk about this time of the year, and there's so much just arguments over stuff that doesn't matter. Like, how many times were you involved in an argument early on in your Twitter career where you argued over a dude that you had ranked like three spots different than a guy, but you guys argued like it was 100 spots away? Like, it was like, yeah, it's like, dude, we value this guy in the same bucket of players. Like, who really cares? Like, it really doesn't matter. So, like, you just don't have to reply. Hard lesson learned. We've all been down that road before. And, like, so the third thing I would say is, like, it's important to understand that, like, not everyone is for everyone on Twitter. And even though we're all fantasy football analysts and we're all under this umbrella of wanting to further fantasy football and wanting to promote people and wanting this all to succeed and grow because as it grows, like, listen – for as long as I've been in fantasy football has continuously been the smallest it's ever been. That's why I've been afforded to, you know, like I said, you know, turn it into a full-time job. It's continuously been the smallest it's ever been. But you have to understand too that, like, even though we're all in the same umbrella, like, it's okay. Like, we're all individuals. Like, you don't have to like everyone. You don't have to follow everyone. You don't have to, you know, have to follow that. When you don't feel obligated to say, like, I have to follow this person because now I'm under this umbrella, like, it's you know, it can get clicky, like high school-ish.
Oh, but it's mega clicky.
You have to understand, though, it's just not, like, it's okay. Like, it's okay if you don't follow. You shouldn't, if someone doesn't follow you, you shouldn't, like, hold that against that person or anyone else. Like, it's okay. It's completely okay. Like, we're all not for each other, and it's completely acceptable to not be for each other and understand that. Like, and, you know, just kind of, like I said, incorporate that into one and two. Like, you don't have to mute someone. Just don't follow them. It's okay. Like, it's okay.
I'm talking about I mute people who at me, who I don't follow, who follow me, who just want to nag me.
Like, the thing about Twitter is, like, that doesn't apply to one or two. Like, I appreciate a good troll. You come in, if you got sharp troll game is real.
Like, if people troll me about something good, like, they're making fun of me in a way that's, like, funny and intelligent, I'll probably retweet you. Like, I've never turned away from that. But if you're just like, you're a loser, your podcast sucks, I'm like, it's not funny, it's not original, it's not even good. So, yeah,
Twitter's essentially gave everyone a voice. Like, how many, like, you have a group of friends, and, like, when you guys get riffing on each other, like, there's, like, a group of friends that, like, are real sharp and can throw some good banter. We got good wit going back and forth. Sure. Like, the jokes are high. We're all laughing at each other. Then you have that one friend that just can't get there. You just can't get to that level of wit. So his first instinct is to, like, say something, like, kind of hurtful that he thinks is funny. You know what I mean? Like, that's, like, that dude that immediately goes to, like, something, like, shitty that happened to you or something like that. It's like, oh, like, that's not even, like, his first thing is just to go to, like, something just, like, derogatory and mean to, like, your person that you are, instead of, like, coming up with something crafty. That's, like, Twitter in a nutshell, basically. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, you don't have to, like, follow someone because you feel like you have to follow them because they've got to see that follow, and then you just end up muting that person. And you're like, I had to mute this person because now I already follow them. Like, just don't follow them. It's cool. Like, it's a lot cool. Like, people are like, it's all right, man. It's cool. Like, it's fine. We're not for everyone. It's important. I think you're probably, like, your early Twitter days are probably more testing that, because I remember – because I was associated, you know, like, you're my dude, man. And, like,
You probably got some negative blowback from me just being like,
I have no problem being associated with you, and never have. And, like, but people would be like, people would say, like, go, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, that's how he handles himself. It's like, no, he's giving takes and he's giving his opinion. Like, it might not be, like, in the form of how you would deliver it, but, like, just unfollow him. Don't follow him. Like, you don't have to. Like, it's cool.
It's true. No one had to follow, but they did anyway.
Yeah, man. They came in your mentions more than you did, obviously.
Yeah. So before we get out of here, we got to get some pop culture takes off. Favorite episode of The Simpsons is what?
Yeah, I'm someone that was there for, like, the beginning of The Simpsons, like, through the apex, although, you know, I obviously trailed off. When's, like, do you still watch The Simpsons now or no?
I have seen every episode of all 29 seasons of it or whatever. It's, like, my favorite show.
Oh, that's impressive. It's a great show. I trailed off.
It's quite bad now. Just I need to put it out there. I only watch it now out of duty and boredom, but it, like, I'll like watch it on, like, the treadmill at the gym or whatever, but, like, it's bad.
Yeah, I want to say, like, around, like, season, like, maybe like 15, like mid 2000s is where I kind of just trailed off. Like where just cause like one, my Sundays became about football and like, yeah. Sun, you know, Simpsons always come out after football and all that stuff. But like, so like, yeah, I'm probably more in like the front half of like where, like I think of the apex of the show as I think most people do anyways, but I would say like some of my, obviously there's the most popular episodes. So we'll try to like refrain from some of those, obviously, like, cause like being a sports fan, like Homer at Bat was like one of my favorite episodes as a kid, you know, seeing all the,
Homer at Bat. All
the,
yep.
Seeing all the baseball stars in the episode was cool. You know, like where Griffey, he gets like the growing the potion and stuff. And then you have the monorail episode, obviously, is famous. But I think a couple of my favorite ones are the one I had to look up this episode when you asked this question and thing, because I didn't know what the name of the episode was. It's called In Marge We Trust, because I actually remember it for the B plot more than the A plot. It's like we're basically like people, they just like acknowledge, you know, obviously the Simpsons have like a bunch of like Catholicism overtones, but like we're basically church. The A plot is basically where church is boring and like Reverend Lovejoy has like become like, he's become like bored of like being a reverend, or like, yeah. Marge takes over and becomes like, you know, she's like helping people out with their problems. But the B plot is where like Homer gets like this video or like his, like looks like his face is like, it's the Mr. Sparkles like logo.
Yeah.
You remember it? Like,
he's on the soapbox from Japan.
Right. And it's like the B plot's so great. And, like it's just discovered that they combined like a light bulb and a fish like combined to like make him. But like, it's such a good B plot. It's just so hilarious that I really like that one. I like Bart Sells a Soul a lot too. And then Bart After Dark, the one where people use the GIF. It's like one of the most famous Simpson GIFs. It's not the one where Homer was back in the bush where Grandpa Simpson walks into the burlesque and like sees Bart
and walks back out.
And walks back out. That's that episode because Bart starts like, I think he like breaks a window at like the burlesque. At the like her house or something.
Yeah,
right?
And he has to go do chores to like help her out.
Yep, he has to do chores at her house. Like starts working and like realizes it's a burlesque place. But they do like a big musical number because like that was when like the first like six or seven episodes of The Simpsons. Like every episode either ended in a song or a riot, and that one had both. It was like a riot that turned into a song. That was that one episode there. But yeah, I mean, definitely those early episodes were where is that though? That was the apex of the show for me.
Like season three is my favorite for sure.
Yeah, because remember when it started, they wanted the show to be about Bart. Like all the media, the show was centered on being a Bart centric show, and then like they immediately like realized it was a Homer show.
Yeah,
and then Undercover, like you got a lot of really good like lease episodes and stuff like that. But like once the show shifted away, because remember I remember being a kid and like the media blitz came and like everyone had, you know, the Bart shirts, the Eat My Short shirts and stuff like that. And all
see,
that
I
stuff
missed,
was out there.
I missed out on all of that because I watched them. What it was is they would show an episode at 4 and 4:30 on my local Fox station every day. So like after school, I would just watch
come home and catch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but they dumped it quick. Like they immediately knew. So the big media blitzkrieg when it started was like, this is a Bart show. Like this is the character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously, you know, Homer just naturally, you know, took that show over by himself.
All right. What is your favorite show of the 2000s? I will let you include The Wire because I think it started in what, like 98, 99?
Yeah. I mean, The Wire was definitely the go-to there. I mean, I think just when you think of The Wire was later. It was it was all 2000s, right?
I don't actually, because The Wire, I was too young. I didn't watch it when it was on TV. I watched it after the fact.
I mean, that was my answer. I thought it was all 2000s, though. I mean, but, you know, The Wire is such a good show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so amazing because, like, you know, obviously on its, like, face value, it's just, like, a show about urban decay. And, like, those obviously everyone, like, gets immediately woke when shows like that drop. But this was, like, a pre-woke era. So, like, you know, it wasn't even popular.
That's actually a good take. It was pre-woke.
Yeah, it was pre-woke because if people remember, The Wire was not really popular at the time it was out. Like, it was a show that's gained a lot of steam now. But at the time, like, they were worried, like, it was going to get – they were going to dump it, like, for a few years. And it wasn't really doing well. But obviously, you know, it was a show – like, the true theme of the show was about, you know, institutions and the failure of those institutions. And, like, the way they were able to, like, to cut through the precision, like, all those themes through the – and use those institutions to, like, show the circle back, like, that urban decay was, like, the way it was crafted was so beautiful. I mean, it was – you know, through the evaporation of jobs, you know, the devaluation of labor in season two, all the shaded politics, police work, you had education system, you know, in season four, then like the negligence of mainstream media, you know, in season five, like all the ways that it was able to circle back to that, you know, soul, like hone in on just what the show is about. Initially, that urban decay, like, was really just so great. And it was cool. It was a police procedural show too, but I think only one police officer fires a shot. But only one police officer fires a shot the whole series of the show. And it's like an accidental, like when Prez fires the shot, like he's the only dude I think that shoots a gun on the show. The entire time the show is on. I also think, like, I have a great pitch. I think it's great in my head. I wanted a great pitch for, like, a sideshow. Like, wouldn't you love to see have, like, a sideshow centered around when, like, Stringer in the first seasons are going to, like, the community college business classes? Like, I would love that. Like, just anything
with Stringer, I would sign me up. Like,
but can't you imagine, like, this dude that's running this copy shop is, like, coming in, and they're, like, you've got, like, all these 18-year-olds, and you've got, like, this 35-year-old dude, like, coming and taking these business classes. I would love just, like, to have, like a show riffed on that. Like, them, it's like, damn it, Stringer. Like, he's, like, all focused and paying attention. He's, like, mad at Evelyn in the corner. She doesn't give a shit. She's trying to get this credit that she was forced to take. Like, I would just love all that. Like, there's a lot of angles we could go from that and turn it into a sideshow.
Or just like any of the Barksdale stuff. Like, you could just like a biopic of Barksdale.
Yeah, absolutely, man. How about that? Spin it back in the time. Like, what was the most underrated show of the 2000s?
It's hard for me to say most underrated, but I continue to believe that people have a negative lens of Lost because they didn't like how it ended and they forgot how great it was when it was on.
Yeah, I remember you've always been a big a Lost guy.
This is like my pop culture take, is that people got so mad about how the last probably 8 episodes of that show went that they just completely bailed on how, like, you're utterly lying to yourself if you watch the first 3 seasons of that show and were not just beyond captivated and into it.
I mean, that's how one of the writers, Damon Lindelof, is like, that's kind of been his MO. Like, what has gotten him in trouble though is like, he's always written things and strung things out to a point where, like, you're like super into him, and then, like, when by the time you get to the payoff, you almost don't care anymore. That's like how he's done a lot of his movies. Yeah, like that, since he's gone from Lost, has done a lot more movies. You know, you think he's brought like Prometheus and like World War Z. These movies that are like
this
good,
might be
like,
this might
the
be
leftovers.
This might be a thing for me, but like I love Prometheus. Like I might be more like psychologically attuned to things that don't pay off 100% than a lot of people.
So you're just like a Lindelof guy, man. I mean, that might be the thing, because like the Leftovers, like season one, is really like that. It's really slow. It's really interesting. Like, these ideas are good. And it gets, you know, Leftovers obviously gets really a lot much better, but like, you know, that Lindelof's kind of, he writes this real slow paced style that almost by the time you get there and, you know, a show that's kind of similar to like that now, not as convoluted. Maybe I think people, I didn't think Lost was, it wasn't as convoluted as people think it was, but like Westworld's kind of like that now, where like they're promising these payoffs, but by the time you get to the payoffs, you're just like so worked over by like,
the
journey.
I don't like Westworld that much. I thought the first season, I thought, spoiler alert, here, have you watched it?
Yeah. I haven't watched the finale of season 2 yet, but like, cause I'm to that point now where, like I said, I'm like past the point of like where I kind of care about the payoff.
Okay. So if you've never seen Westworld and you don't care, whatever, but we're going to talk about plot points. So I haven't watched a lot of season 2 yet either, but I will say, the reveal at the end of season 1 that the man in black is William is,
yeah,
that's like one of, that's probably one of the 10 best moments in television that I can even ever remember.
But were you even shocked at that point? Like, to me, the reveal was like 4 episodes, like hand over fist. Like, we all knew that that was the reveal coming, and like, it just took so long to get there.
So I didn't read any Westworld content. I came to it way after. So I was not prepared for that reveal.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, I can see where, like, if you were, like, sunk in, and not to be, like, an elitist about that, I don't want to say, like,
I just told you so.
Like, you know, it was one of those things where, to me, it was, like, obvious for a while, and it was like, just get us there, and it just wouldn't deliver, and then you get the reveal, and I get lost in this, it just lost in the steam of the reveal. Because yeah. Like I said, the way it was written, it's so slow-paced and so you know, almost gets, you know, it's almost starts to meander. I think that's just his writing style though. And how it gets, I mean, I think it, like you look at all the stuff too. I mean, Tomorrowland's another movie too. Like that's another movie that he wrote and it's like the ideas are there for that to be good. It just doesn't deliver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other pop culture takes? Are we there?
Well, listen, man, we wanted to get one take in, you know, because we wanted to talk about the Zach Morris thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny now because it's come to light, you know, that there's like that Zach Morris is trash thing now. And, you know, I've had to defend myself to like Twitter people now, like, because, you know, the Zach Morris is trash brand has grown and he's got this thing. But I think that a lot of people don't really remember like how like unbelievably awful like 90s TV was. And like we were kind of talking about this, you and I, and like how you were just a little later. So like 90s TV is probably like one of the worst areas of TV. I mean, it was really every 90s like lead character was written through like just this misogynistic episode. Oh, yeah. Like that was what those guys were. I mean, obviously, so it's like easily go back. I feel bad because, you know, I'm not trying to defend the Zach Morris AVI. I'll get to why I chose it in a second. Because I promise you that if this is just the beginning, your next favorite character is going to get this same treatment.
Oh, 100%, literally.
Because we were in a decade where, like, the big shows, you think of something like a big shows like Baywatch, Married with Children, or big sitcoms, you know, obviously Home Improvement. I mean, all your shows did this. Even shows that necessarily weren't. I mean, Elaine had to show her breasts on an episode of Seinfeld for, like, a potential, like, boss for George. I mean, Phoebe on Friends had to show her breasts to, like, win a football game. There's, like, all these characters written as douchebags. Wait till someone does, you know, uncovers a thing on Will Smith on Fresh Prince.
That was the first thought I had. I was like, all my memories of Fresh Prince are so pure, and dude. I like just it's wrecked. It's over. Like someone's gonna get into it and be like, man, he was such a dick.
Dude, wait till this happens. Will Smith was like essentially like urban Zach Morris, dude. Just wait, yeah. It's coming. Like it's coming, man. And he was even way worse to women, you know, on that show when you go back to that. Though. It was just a truly terrible time, you know, for lead male arcs to be written. And you know, we were unfortunately that was the part of the being a youth of that era. Like all those characters are written that way. I mean, the reason I chose like the Zach Morris, and like that's a show that doesn't hold up. I remember when Saved by the Bell came on Netflix, I wanted to show it to my kids. I was like, oh shit, this show is awful now. Like, damn, how do we even ever like this show? It's so just not just even the way it's written, it's just a bad TV show. But I remember like that and like that photo of Zach Morris, and like that just like sums up like from like my fantasy football stance. It's like just being unflappable and like having an answer. Like I'll figure this out. And that's kind of how I treated it and just kind of like stuck. You know, kind of like the Lord.
I didn't even know that there was a story behind it, so that's great.
Yeah. I mean, Zach Morris, because he was that guy in that picture. He just had that look at his face. He said he just kind of, you know, was just unflappable no matter, like, what kind of, like, awful thing happened. And that's kind of the mind approach you have to have in fantasy football, because, like, some awful – you're going to fall on a lot of landmines in fantasy football. But fantasy football is a game of adjustments. We talk about the summer and how we handle winning your draft and how, like, really non-important it is. If there's a level of importance, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. But, like, fantasy football has always been a game of counterpunching. It always is. Because your rankings, your ADP is always going to be a direct reflection of what just happened and not what is going to happen. That's just how fantasy football has always been played. It's circular, chases its own tail. But it's a game that's about counterpunching. And that's kind of how, like, that was. I mean, now going back in hindsight, and we can uncover some of the ways Zach Morris got through some of these decisions, you know, and some of the schemes he came up with to get through, and like it comes to light that he was kind of an awful person and kind of a douchebag. But you know, he was a way it was like, I guess, you know what, screw it, man. Like this, I can either, you know, stick my head down and it's going to be completely screwed for me, or I can get out of this. You know, I can make this happen. That's how you got to play fantasy football, man. It's a game of adjustments. You know, you talk about having David Johnson last year. I mean, I had David Johnson in some leagues too. I had him probably in five or six redraft leagues. I think I made the playoffs in all of them but one. Because, you know, you come back and you find ways to find an edge. It's the way fantasy football is played. There's still 13, 12 other mini seasons you had outside of the David Johnson injury that you had a chance to calibrate your roster and get in the playoffs.
Yeah, but I'm no Roto Reeves, man.
No, but this is the thing we always talk about. I remember, listen, I was long in your ear of texting you, and it's like, hey, man, why are you even playing redraft? Because you're that dude that's into it for, like, 3 or 4 weeks, and, like, you just have too much other stuff going on.
Well, my thing now is, like, I just limit the leagues. Best ball is good for me because, like, obviously I don't have to mess up every week.
Perfect format for you.
And now I'll just do 3 or 4 redraft leagues. And, like, I don't mean this to be there's probably like a really perfect Jewish word for this that I could come up. I don't mean to be flippant, but like I will probably get more down on one Sunday in NFL DFS than all of my redraft entry combined. And I don't go into entering any redraft league thinking, well, I'm just gonna not care about this. It's just kind of it's a consequence of the choices I make over the course of this.
It's a manifestation.
Yeah, like, but yeah, I mean, that's... I don't mean to be a dick. It just ends up happening.
Hey, man, skateboard lost a wheel.
Skateboard lost a wheel. That's a great way for us to end here, man. That was a fantastic show. Pimp out the worksheet and everything that you need to do.
Yeah, I mean, the worksheet, the series has started underway for the summer series I do every year at Roto World. That's kind of moving downhill. The draft guide's going to drop in a few weeks. I think the online draft guide starts today is going to be available. And if you're going to grab one, I know it's cool to, like, grab magazines, I guess, or it's not cool. I don't even know anymore. But the online ones you want to get because the actual projections and all the information gets updated throughout that on the online draft guide. I do all the projections, the tiers, the individual profiles that associate with the rankings there for players. So like the Aaron Jones news, all these suspensions just dropped on, you know, the July 3rd. All that's already accounted for in the projections over there on the online guide. But if you got that print guide, none of that stuff gets updated throughout the summer. Someone's going to tear their ACL here in about 3 weeks when these things get underway. I won't pinpoint any player and put that juju on them, but it's going to happen. That stuff gets updated. They're constantly churning. Like you said, it's a game of counterpunching. You know, it's not a game you can have a long, hard out plan in because these seasonal numbers, one, don't mean a lot of things in context when you're looking at it just in bulk of what's happened and transpired. And these projections in bulk don't mean what you think they're going to mean as well. Basically, all these players are going to be relevant for a certain pocket of the season that we all hate or don't like. It's just whether you're in that right pocket or not.
There we go. Follow the man. Find the man's content. Find out what to do when Jamal Williams tears his ACL. There we go. I'll put the juju on. I don't care.
Everyone, Jamal Williams is the most anti-Davis player I could ever come to think about.
No, I'm not in. I'm 0% in on Jamal Williams. I'm team Timont, which I never thought I would say, because for a short time he was responsible for keeping Jeff Janis on the bench. Everyone. Rating, review on the show, giving away a membership to the Fantasy National Golf Club. If you go to my Twitter, it is the pinned tweet, but for real, just leave a rating and review on the show. If you do it, I'll be nice to you. If you do it and I've muted you on Twitter, maybe I'll unmute you. Maybe I'll do something kind for you. But that's going to do it for us today.